This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Many people have difficulties believing the elderly to be sexual beings with sexual needs. Joining us to debunk these myths about aging and sexuality and to discuss socio-cultural perspectives on sexual intimacy among the elderly are rehabilitation physician Dr. Intan Sabrina Muhammad and Professor Lawa Yun, the head of Department of Research in University of Malaya Medical Center and a psychologist by profession. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you very much.
What do we know about the sexual health of older Malaysian adults?
Right. Talking about sexuality in the aging couple, there are, of course, lots of myths pertaining to it. And I think as healthcare professionals, we do need to demystify some of these myths and misconceptions of sexuality related to older persons. We are born with sexuality from womb to tomb, whether you like it or not. So it's really, you know, part of ourselves, the whole totality of being human. And of course, when we talk about sexuality in the aging couple, it encompasses biological, psychological, social, cultural, and of course, finally, the spirituality of it. So what are the do's and don'ts related to sexual-related matters as far as aging is concerned? So sexual health, it's part of the overall quality of life of anyone, irrespective of whether you are young or aging. So therefore, I think that it's important for us to actually promote sexuality in later life in aging couples.
And when we look at the current information, what do we have? What do we know for sure about sexuality in the older Asian couple?
Right. As far as Malaysia is concerned, we do have our own local data pertaining to Malaysian elderly person, those above midlife, for instance, above 40, and also currently latest published studies on those over 60 years of age. So we do have data, but it's kind of very limited, very scanty as far as prevalence of the various sexual dysfunction is concerned. I'm particularly involved pertaining to sexual and reproductive health. You know, I started off with adolescent and then move on to the elderly. And we did a community-based study as far as men is concerned. This is, you know, men's health. And we find that, for instance, erectile dysfunction, we do have about 38% of our male above 40 years of age do have some kind of a sexual dysfunction, mainly erectile dysfunction. And as far as the female is concerned, it all depends whether they are menopausal or non-menopausal. Those who are menopausal, one would assume that they will have a higher female sexual dysfunction as compared to those who are not menopausing. And, of course, all this relates to the hormonal changes in their body. So we do have some data, but rather limited. And therefore, I think as healthcare practitioners, health educators, we do need a bit more study to amplify all these sexual issues related to aging.
And as you mentioned, sexuality is important throughout our lives. It's something that's present. But what role does it play in the well-being of older adults?
No, like I said again, we look at sexuality from a multimodal perspective, from a biological perspective, psychological perspective. So like, for instance, one's own self-esteem, you know, when you age, of course, the frequency of sexual behavior practices, it's more or less decreased. So it doesn't mean it doesn't happen at all, but the frequency actually decreases. So when the frequency of sexual intercourse decreases, so then they will opt for other, you know, self-gratifying practices, not just in terms of sexual intercourse, penetration and what have you, but of course they go for touching, you know, other sort of non-penetrative sexual behavior. Studies have actually shown that although they are aging, the sexual desire is still there, but of a lower extent or severity.
Dr. Intan, is this also what you've observed in your work?
Yes. It's interesting, you know, amongst our medical fraternity itself, not everybody is comfortable discussing about sexual health unless it affects the sexual organs, such as if you have a breast cancer. You will ask your surgeon to say, hey, you know, am I still a woman? Can I even have sex? And for example, if you have cancer of the uterus or ovaries, will that make me less of a woman? What kind of penetrative sex can I have? And for the men as well, prostate cancer is very common. So prostate gets enlarged, after the age of 50. They have a lot of problems passing urine. The frequency of getting up and going to the toilet actually makes it unattractive to engage in sexual activities. So that's one. And diabetes is very common, but everybody knows about the sugar control. They do not know that the relationship between good glucose control with healthy and better sexual health.
As a subject, why is sex in later life so taboo? Why do people prefer to just not address it, even in the medical fraternity?
Yeah, it's not just among the medical professionals themselves, but I think, first of all, society's expectation and the cultural taboos as well. Particularly, I think, not just in Malaysia, but in the Asian context as well, because we still come from a very conservative society, where the minute you age, you know, how society actually build them. Like, for instance, if you see an elderly couple holding hands, so to the youngsters, it's like, oh my, they're old and yet they're still holding hands, you know, things like that. So again, I think it's society's expectation of how they view sexuality in the aging couple. And as far as the medical fraternity is concerned, I think sometimes it's also their own comfort in dealing with sexual issues. And if they're not comfortable dealing with sexual issues, then I think they wouldn't want to talk about it. So, and as a result of that, you know, a person with sexual issues then would not dare to voice out during any of the clinical consultation with their own medical doctors.
Or even refer to those who are comfortable with the subject.
Yes.
So, you know, you are not comfortable with your own sexuality, and then somebody asks you of questions that you're not comfortable with, let alone know much about. Under the Medical Malaysian Council, you are supposed to practice within your own specialty. And if you are not comfortable, I mean, you're not well-versed in that, you're supposed to refer. So whether that happens on the ground is another thing.
Are there enough doctors who are kind of open to talking about this, though? I mean, because if you are outnumbered, then that conversation is always going to be very difficult to be had.
Yeah, it all depends on the speciality of the doctors, I must say. So like, I think the one that is more comfortable talking about sexuality perhaps are the obstetrician and the gynecologist, because they deal with a woman's health per se. And then followed by, say, for instance, urologist, who deals with many issues. And, of course, you know, some general practitioners who are actually trained in sexual medicine, for instance. So I think the bottom line is this. We are trying to encourage doctors, general practitioners out there, specialists, to talk about sexual health issues with their patients. Because what we found is that patients always want to be asked first by their doctors. And here we are trying to promote doctors in being comfortable, first of all, with your own sexuality. And this is what I teach my medical students. If they are not comfortable with their own sexuality, it's very, very difficult to deal with someone's sexuality. Because at the end of the day, the patients will see you through and through, that through your gestures, whether you are comfortable or not comfortable dealing with sexual matters. So very important, one really has to be comfortable with one's sexuality before you can deal with another person. So there's especially different types of speciality. But here we are trying to help doctors to bring up issues with their patients.
Because we do know
that there is a clear relationship between medical conditions and sexual functioning.
I would add to that, as rehab physicians, it's actually part of our training, because a lot of disabled people, such as spinal cord injury, that is the first thing that they think, you know, second thing. First thing, they want to walk. Can I walk when I'm paralyzed? Second is, doctor, can I have sex? Can I be a father or a mother? So naturally, in our training, we are trained to deal with such questions and how to explore treatment options. Another specialty I think is quite well-versed is the psychiatrist, because you can't separate between psychological problems like depression, anxiety and stress with erectile dysfunction or the nothing happening in the bedroom. So usually they get depressed, and they, you know, when you're depressed, who else do you go to? It's usually psychiatrists, not psychologists, because they don't know psychologists. What do you do? Yeah. What's the difference between a psychologist
it's
and
because a... they don't know, you know, who else are trained in, let's say, marital and relationship issues or sexual issues. And of course, they would then quickly refer to a psychiatrist.
Who just, you know, dish out pills, antidepressants.
I'm speaking today with Dr. Intan Sabrina Mohammed and Professor Lawa Yun. We're talking about sexuality in later life and how it can affect well-being as a whole. Up next, we find out what are the myths of sexuality in aging couples. If you've got any questions, feel free to send them in. That number to text is 016-201-9000. You can also tweet us at PFM Radio. Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. My guest today, Dr. Intan Sabrina Mohammed, rehabilitation physician, and Professor Lawa Yun, head of Department of Research at University Malaya Medical Center. And we're talking about sexuality in later life, something that might have some people squirming in their chairs, but we nevertheless believe that it's important to address. And Professor Lau, earlier you mentioned that it's important to debunk myths. What are some of these myths?
One of them could be, particularly I think in our society or in the Asian society itself, it's the consumption of the traditional complementary medicine. I think a lot of people who may have a sexual difficulty or a sexual problem, they tend to head towards the TCM and then Western medicine. Why? It's because, now, when you go to TCM practitioner, they don't ask you 1,001 questions, right? So it's very easy to obtain that because when you talk about sexuality, it's very intimate, very personal kind of issues. So they don't like to be asked those sort of behavior. Whereas you go and see your Western doctors, they ask you 1,001 questions regarding your sexual behavior. And as a result of that, you know, they turn to TCM. And after turning to TCM, after taking some herbs or whatever, you know, they find they feel good. Basically, what it does is, you know, it increases your general well-being. And once your overall general well-being is increased, definitely your sexual well-being is also better. So basically, when we talk about TCM, people think that once you go for any sort of herbs or Tonka Lali or Kecap Fatima and whatnot, it will help you solve your sexual issues. So that is perhaps due to the cultural belief as well, that we believe, you know, we are brought up in a certain ethnic group, cultural belief, and then we turn to specific medication or treatment. So that is one. The other one is, again, I've said that it's a stereotyping, the cultural issues as to how we see older people. When we see older people, the society perception is that they shouldn't have sex anymore. And here, what we do see in our society, perhaps in others as well, Koreans or Japanese, that once they reach a certain age, they even sleep in separate bedrooms. So just because they're old, that doesn't mean they cannot have sex. For as long as an elderly couple is still very free, don't have the various medical conditions, then he or she is still able to have sexual activities. So I think the myth is that just because you're old, you know, you cannot have sex.
I'm also curious as to whether penetrative sex is privileged over other forms of intimacy, because I think if it's what you're accustomed to doing for much of your life, then perhaps later on when that ability is diminished or when it just becomes a little bit more difficult, you know, whether or not that can affect you, even though other avenues of intimacy might be open to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, here again, I think it is how we define sexual activities or sexual behavior. People tend to relate sexual behavior when I ask them what sexuality is all about. What is sexual behavior? The first thing that comes up from mind is penetrative sex or sexual intercourse. So the thing is, sometimes, you know, you do need to educate that, you know, sexuality is not just about penetrative sex. It encompasses everything, touching, kissing, and what have you. So I think as you age, we do know that frequency of sex decreases, and as a result of that, there are other sexual values that come into place as well. So it's not just about penetrative sex.
I would like to add, it's surprising for people who have been married for a long time and have children. They do not actually understand the anatomy of their own body, more the opposite sex. So as a promotion, I was curious to know amongst our healthcare providers, not necessarily doctors, just like nurses or administrative staff in the hospital, they do not know which are the erogenous zones, sensitive parts of the body, not necessarily the genitalia, your private parts, but your body. So massage is actually, coming back to traditional complementary medicine, people believe that you go for massage and it will cure you. In a way, it is correct because it improves blood circulation. So when you have good blood circulation and you feel good, and the endorphins actually make you feel better, so naturally you're happier. Now, there are four stages, main stages of the sexual response. First is the sexual desire. you feel sexy or not. Are you in the mood? So another one is the sexual arousal. When you decide to engage in some sort of sexual activities, how long do you take to actually enjoy it and reach orgasm? Third is the orgasm. For a woman, an orgasm, it does not mean the end. We can have multiple orgasms and then we can still go on. For a man, usually when they reach orgasm, they ejaculate. And the fourth stage is the resolution. So for a guy, for a male, once they reach orgasm, you ejaculate and then, you know, shutdown mode. If you do not understand how aging, the physiological aging process affect these sexual responses, you may not know how to deal with it, and then you blame, you're guilty, and then it presents as a blame, blaming the elderly, not sexy partner. You know, you're too baggy, you're too crinkled, that's why you don't turn me on. And then they go elsewhere, have extramarital sex, polygamy. You know, maybe it's the wife and not them. So to actually admit that there's something wrong, this is why we are here. We are here to educate that before you pop a pill that doesn't come from Kementerian Kesihatan Malaysia, please discuss with your doctor. Your GP should be able to discuss your medical condition and direct you to the right professional. And then we prescribe the treatment and then go. If you want to go for traditional medicine, by all means. But get your medical condition sorted first.
Could I just add into that? In a sense that when one reaches a later phase of their life, sexual values differ. For instance, when you are much younger, you're so busy looking after your kids, the relationship between your spouse or your partner differs. But the minute you reach later stage in life, your kids are all overseas. Yeah, your kids are all having a life of their own. And suddenly, you find that two of you are alone again in a house. And therefore, you have all the time to yourself. You do need to rekindle or reclaim that sexuality. Because when you are much younger, you were busy making your millions in a business. You're taking care of your kids and what have you. So once you reach that part, kids are no longer around. Then you have to rethink how you view sexuality within the couple themselves. The other issue about later life is you might lose your partner or your spouse, and therefore you are then alone again. So how are you going to deal with that sexual part of you? So I think when you reach a certain point in life at a later age, so values differs because you're influenced by kids not being around, you're all on your own, or you lost a loved one, or it may be your spouse or your partner, or you may meet a new person. And when you need a new person at a stage in life, of course, the whole issue of safe sex has to come in because you're not sure as to your new partner is having how many partners over there. So I think all these other values, sexuality in later part of one's life, we do need to consider all these factors as well because it affects sexual functioning.
A 2013 study from UPM, University Putrajaya, did find that higher levels of education correlate with more sexual activity in old age. Do we know what might explain this?
Yeah. Well, there are several explanations, not just pertaining to sexual issues, but it's in any medical conditions. The more educated you are, the more chances of you being accessible to a healthcare, whether the healthcare is a public healthcare or a private healthcare. In a sense that the more educated you are, perhaps you know your occupation is higher and you have access to information, for instance, and being more knowledgeable. So therefore, you seek help earlier. So it doesn't mean that they have more sexual issues or sexual activity, but because they're accessible to knowledge in this day and age where internet technologies are all there and these people have the means in terms of finance to go and seek help.
Correct. Yes, exactly. I asked the authors of that study, and it's a study conducted by Tengku Aizan, who's also the chairman, and my colleague, Dr. Rahima. So I said, why do highly educated people more, you know, sexually savvy? She said, well, if you have higher education, you have better jobs, more money, so you don't have to work 2-3 shifts, and you are not that tired. So if you are a blue-collar job, you've got to work 2-3 shifts, and then financial pressure, that's the last thing you want to do. So the third thing is actually when you are you have higher education, you can communicate better, I think, and then you are able to cope with the daily pressures of life. Yeah. So you have better coping mm-hmm. skills,
yeah.
so you don't blame your partner.
Better coping skills, it's not just a question of finance, but I think because once you're educated, you know your sexual rights, you know your rights to information, your rights to accessibility of healthcare, you know where to go for help, as compared to someone who is not that educated. So, I mean, that's a link between higher education and not just pertaining to sexual problem, but any other medical conditions you could see.
That study also found ethnic disparity, and we talked a little bit about that earlier in terms of the kinds of help that is sought when there are problems in the bedroom. But what are the other differences that come out in terms of ethnic disparity?
Okay. You have to understand, in Malaysia, you know, it's like almost synonymous. Culture equals to race equals to beliefs. So 99.9, I will not say 100%, 99.99 of the Malays are Muslims. Okay, and then the Chinese, about what, 55% now? They could be Christians, Buddhists, and also some have converted into Islam. And then the Indians also, they are Hindus, as well as Christians, and also Islam converts. So I asked the authors, I said, okay, so what's the difference? In the Chinese culture, the Taoism, okay, they teach self-control, energy conservation, rejuvenation, which could encompass sexual enjoyment, health development, and reproduction. So Taoism promotes all this improvement in these domains. Reproduction, yes, people do it, you know, they develop. But when it comes to sexual enjoyment, not much is being promoted. Okay, the Buddhists, the ultimate goal is to reach nirvana, perfect peace. Sexual activities beyond reproductive purposes distract one from improving one's karma. So it's like a distraction. So, very, very conservative. Okay, next is the Islams, the Muslims. Okay, in the Muslim culture, sex between married couples is actually mandatory. Okay, it's encouraged, and you actually get points if you do it on a Friday night. Yeah, Friday night, you get extra points. It's like wearing your best Sunday shirt to go to church. So you get points. But Islam prohibits extramarital sex. So coming to Prof. Lo's point just now, the bereavement, the loss of partner. If you're not married, you meet somebody, and then, you know, you're all... Marriage is a very serious commitment. It's not just like, you know, lifelong social thing, but it's also financial. And then what would your children think? So casual sex is actually a no-no in Islam. So what do? You've lost your partner, you're lonely, you want to enjoy, you meet somebody you like.
You have to marry them.
Yeah, exactly. You have to marry them. And then the Christians as well, and the Catholics, you know, you have a lot of these religious influence on the culture, and then the culture on your personal beliefs, and then being the color of your skin. If you start having sexual enjoyment beyond the confines of your religion, you'll be frowned upon. So I think those are the factors that represent the disparity.
I think irrespective of, you know, cultures and religion as well, I think all of us, first of all, are all sexual beings, very important, yeah? And a certain religion, in fact, I think all religion and society prescribe certain rules and regulations as far as sexual behavior is concerned. For instance, in our society, you know, society prescribe, you know, now the way we express our sexuality is not in public. You don't find somebody kissing, having sex in the public, unlike other more open society. So in our society, society prescribed we should not be expressing our sexual behavior out in the public. Certain behaviors are behind closed doors. So doesn't matter what your religion is, doesn't matter your cultural background, your ethnic group, but there are certain rules and regulations that our society, our religion prescribe, the do's and don'ts of certain sexual behavior.
And are problems of intimacy in later life more affected by psychology or by biology?
It's a combination of both. because when we see sexuality, we look at it from the biopsychosocial model, from a biological perspective, as what I think Dr. Intan Sobrena has mentioned, from a physiological perspective, your hormonal change and your sexual organs, anatomy and your sexual givens. The psychological as well, you know, your own anxiety, your self-esteem, your gender identity, your sexual orientation, all these influences. And of course, social cultural perspective as well. I think we have stressed a lot on social cultural perspective, and of course the other issues on spirituality as well. Mm-hmm. So all those does affect sexuality in a person.
The biological part, and that's the neurobiology, there's a certain part of your brain that actually controls your hunger, your thirst, your sleep, even your sexual needs and your sexual drive. So if anyone has problems with these four domains, you need to see a doctor, because it could be a thyroid disorder, you've got a tumor in your brain. It's not just psychology. So have a talk with your doctor. You probably need a brain scan, blood test. It may be fixed, actually.
A lot of what we're talking about today should start at home in many ways, because we should be able to have these conversations first with your children and as children with your parents. But thinking about parents as sexual beings can, of course, be deeply uncomfortable. I think even me saying it out loud has caused some people to cringe. How can we talk more openly about sex within the family?
Right. It is not within a family. I think in our education system as well, what the Ministry of Women and under the National Population and Family Planning Unit, they or Ministry of Education, they do have this social and reproductive education as well, where they actually taught in school, but by different phases. So it's sort of incorporated in the different years of education. They started off with the primary and now moving on to the secondary as well. So you start off in schools educating our younger person. But of course, they still do not want to use the term sexuality education, because it's still a very taboo subject. So they change it into social and reproductive health education, which is a mouthful. You know, you talk to the kid, you know, the kid would say, what the hell is that, you know?
It's so the birds and the bees.
It's just, you know, sexuality education. Yeah. So that is what our government is doing right now, trying to educate people. And of course, you have NGOs, for instance, the Federation of Family Planning Association Malaysia. They have their own programs in terms of educating the public regarding sexual issues as well. And of course, the other one would be like focus on family, and they have their own sex education program as well. But as far as family is concerned, I think parents themselves need to be educated as to how to talk about the bees and the birds, you know, to their kids. But of course, when we talk to our kids, it has to be when they are much younger, we give them in small doses. Those were the days where when you ask your parents, you know, how did it came about to this? Well, oh, you know, I pick it up from a dustbin. I think those kind of, we shouldn't be telling our kids that they pick up from a dustbin or that the birds send it to us and what have you. So I think one has to tell exactly the actual facts, but by small dosage, depending on the age of the kids. So we would like to tailor-make sexuality education program based on the age of the kids. But parents themselves need to be comfortable. Very often within a family, the parents who are not comfortable say, why don't you go to school and ask the teacher rather than us? Yeah.
As a mother of four, I have a 16, 12, 7 and 5. So we start early, and my husband wants to get in earlier than me, because I will rattle off my clinical take on the non-sexy part of the birds and the bees. So as young as 2 years old, we educate. This is the part where you pass urine. And this is the part when, you know, when you have boobs and when you have blood coming out. This is the part, oh, mommy, where did I come from? You go like, okay, I married your father. I slept with him. Okay. We kiss and we love each other. And he put his sperm and my egg. That's my kid. His sperm and my egg met in my tummy. And then you were born. So we make it as a small doses, a very, very childlike. So they like to watch, to go through their baby book. So going through the scans, the ultrasound, you know, start from that. Then we know that when they go to a babysitter, and the husband or the babysitter, they know, hey, you can't do things to me. And this moves on to the adolescent. My 12-year-old, she hasn't got her period yet, but we are not worried about her because we talk about protective sex. We talk about, they also have programs in the school about vaccination, the cervical HPV vaccination. So you start to inject the safe sex, and then the 16-year-old, he basically knows it, but he doesn't want to talk or ask because it's been drilled from 2 years old. So there's, in our household, we talk about it often, and they don't even want to know because they know too much already. So by the time they're 65 and above, it's not a taboo anymore.
Yeah. I think in this day and age, it's best for us to talk about these issues with our own kids, because with the advent of internet technology and what have you, we do find that a lot of people are actually turning to the internet for information. And some of those information found in the internet may not be reliable, those information. So I think it's best for us to get our own people, the teachers themselves, so to hear it from reliable sources rather than from the internet or watching some sort of pornography. So I think that's the danger of this internet technology.
There's an upcoming conference titled Intimacy and Sexuality in Later Life, taking place from the 18th to the 20th of November. Could you tell us more about it?
Yes, we are part of the organizers. This is a collaboration between the Ministry of Health, multiple hospitals like Hospital Rehabilitasi Cheras, Hospital Putrajaya, Hospital Kuala Lumpur and Hospital Sungai Buloh, including speakers from outer states like Hospital Sultan Ismail. We are collaborating with University Putra Malaysia, the Institute of Gerontology, or better known now as My Aging, United Nations Population Fund, and also the Gerontology Society of Malaysia. This is a platform for researchers in the university to talk to clinicians like us who actually deal with patients. So we can discuss on the last day. The ultimate summit is to sit down and decide on a consensus on how to approach patients, what are the treatment options, what can we do about it? So we urge your listeners to go online, www.isill2016.upm.edu.my, for further information.
Thank you both very much for coming in today. I've been speaking with Dr. Intan Sabrina Mohammed, rehabilitation physician, and Professor Loa Yun, head of Department of Research at University Malaya Medical Center, and we've been discussing sexuality in later life. You've been listening today to Live and Learn, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.